I don't know how far we're going to get with this tonight, because I have an enormous, enormous amount of material. But what I'll do is this. I'll just go until it gets to be an hour and a half, if it looks like it's going to run long. And then just quit, find a reasonable place and just quit. A mythographer is someone who writes down myths, or in some way preserves myths. In some cases, they have been accused of creating them. And most mythographers have been artists, poets, and bards, and minstrels, and playwrights, but sometimes, beside the musical and word arts, sometimes it's actually been painters and even ceramicists that have preserved the myths in pictorial form. Some people have actually woven very complex myths into rugs, and so that you could, that every, you know, you could just spend hours going around looking at a rug and seeing, you know, sequentially that the whole thing would be a spiral and would tell the whole story in pictures like that. It's quite wonderful things that they've done. Now, that's not just merely a passing interest, that it's mostly artists that do it. It's because the artists have the sensitivity that they do, that they're attuned to the higher realms in the desire world. And that being the case, they have the ability to be in touch with the very stuff that our lives are made of. And that gets collected together in their mythical work. And a lot of these artists have also been mystical. And they raise themselves by raising others. It has been their duty that from time to time someone like that comes along and they tell the stories in such a way that it sets you shivering and it uplifts you and it makes your life worthwhile and such like that. And we usually try to be better as human beings. I sometimes just have a minor experience just going out to hear some music or something like that. And when I come back, I strive much harder because the shared experience of somebody doing something like that makes me feel better. The mystical interests of the artists were part of that same sensitivity. It was at the very core of their being. In fact, at one time, all of the arts evolved out of priesthood. At one time, all of culture was maintained by priests, whether it was medicine and science or whether it was the arts. They all evolved out of things, you know, like most of the sciences evolved out of astrology and having an accurate way for making horoscopes. Mathematics developed for the same reason. And like, for example, music and poetry came from a form of chanting. Previously, people inwardly used to hear the word and try to attune themselves inwardly to it. And as they became more and more focused in the material world, spiritual exercises were based on singing kind of chants, mantra chants and things like that. And they were what were used to get back in touch with the spiritual world that was being lost. For example, one of the things that we've been talking about for a long time, remember when Heracles always wore the white aspen thing, crown around his head? That was mostly the northern view of Heracles, and that was called Heracles of the Dactyls, because the dactylic priests would go into either aspen, but most usually white birch groves, and they would do their chanting there. And when they did their chanting, they touched their hands like this, their fingers, and they pinched their fingers because they would get sensations in their bones. And from that, there would be an awakening of spiritual consciousness. It's very much, there's a thing that's in all of our Western languages that goes all the way back to Plato, that the deepest kind of understanding or knowing of something is a feeling in your bones. That goes way back to the Timaeus by Plato. In the Western mystery schools, we know that the divine spirit has primary and secondary seats in the body, and the life spirit the same. The human spirit, for example, has its primary seat in the pineal gland and its secondary seat in the nervous system, and it's associated with the reflecting ether and all of the thinking activity, whereas the life spirit has its primary seat it has it in the pituitary body and in the light ether, but its secondary seat is right within the circulatory system, within the blood itself. But the blood is created in the marrow of the bones, and the divine spirit has its seat at the root of the nose near the silent watcher, and its secondary seat is in the heart of the bones. And so what we call even in our modern poetry, like dithyrambic meter and all of those kinds of things, came from dances and chants and mantras and things like that that were still practiced in ancient Greek. And if you look up in a Greek poetry book where all of the meters are defined, if you want to do some research, look up dactylic measure, and that'll give you some insight into what pattern they used for taking each phalange and pressing against it as they were chanting their poetry to Heracles of the dactyls. So all of our arts have come out of the priestly craft. And that is what we're looking at now is no exception. We're looking at what is called the ring of the Nibelungen. And that is a cycle of myths that goes way back. It has roots that can be found in Greece, and it's found in all of the Teutonic peoples and in the Nordic peoples. And the form that we're using, as we said last week, we're choosing an artistic form as written down by Richard Wagner, who did a lot of research in choosing which myth to use for this grand epic. Well, he didn't set out at first to make a grand epic of it. And when he was all done, he wrote the Composer's Book, which is a big, thick book, and wrote a book on the place of music and poetry and the duty of the artist in recreating the myths and giving them new spiritual import from time to time. And that's what the Ring of the Nibelungen is all about. Now, Wagner was himself very much involved with mysticism, and he got quite away with it. In fact, in his later life, it was quite something. By the end of his life, he was a celibate and a vegetarian, and even a meek man. But his earlier life wasn't that way at all. He was a tremendous womanizer. He was brilliant, but he was egoistical and egotistical, and he had to sleep in satin, and when he wore clothing, it had to be fine velvet and things like that. And he always had wealthy people that sponsored him. I don't know if he was giving him a Gemini con or what, but he always had a coterie of ladies around him. He eventually ended up marrying his best friend's daughter, Cosima Liszt, the daughter of Franz Liszt, who was his closest friend. And Wagner was a big egoist. when he was writing the music for Tristan and Isolde, which was another one of his mythical themes, he wrote to Liszt and he said, "I have just written the most beautiful music the world has ever heard." That's a Mars and Aquarius kind of attitude. Other people, you know, there's Mars and Aquarius gets very braggadocious about intellectual skills and pride and things like that. Old Charlie de Gaulle had Mars in Aquarius, and he said, "I am France." So as though he were the old king, like that. Now, Wagner didn't always put all of his thought into mysticism. Early in life, he was extremely politically active, and he thought it was the duty of music to start revolutions. He was big on changing society. In fact, all of the operas that we're looking at, I don't think we'll take the time to do it, but all of the operas that we're looking at could be interpreted in terms of national socialism. Not necessarily Nazism, but real socialism. And when Wagner was conducting in London, one of his greatest champions was this curious man who wrote for one of the leading newspapers, but that was a nom de plume for George Bernard Shaw. And he was writing musical reviews for the newspapers, and he kept championing Wagner. And eventually, he wrote what became a book called The Perfect Wagnerite. I have a rare copy of it. It's got all these neat cartoons in it. And it is an interpretation of the Ring of the Nibelungen as a doctrine of, or a document for, social revolution, where the working class overthrows the lordly class and rises to its own self rulership. It's a cute book, and it's pretty well written. However, by the end of Wagner's life, when he was writing Parsifal, he was living a Parsifal-like life. He lived a very, very pure life and became very devout. Somewhere in there, in the middle of it, he was a self-proclaimed seer, meaning to say that he saw things out of the spiritual worlds, and literally, when he heard music, he saw colors. He even claimed that the second opera that we're going to be going into, that it's called The Walküre, in that there are the women, the Walküres, who represent the planetary spirits that fly through the heavens, and they bring the brave warriors to Valhalla, which is the castle of the gods, provided they have fought for the truth all of their life. And they're all daughters of truth. We're going to hear a lot about them. But they have this wild and eerie song. And Richard Wagner claimed that when he was in Switzerland scoring the music to this song, that the nature spirits that were in the air sang the music to him. What is interesting is that at a much later time, that when Geoffrey Hodgson, who is to me one of the most respectable theosophical seers that has ever been, he really put it on the line and made predictions that could be tested out later on, after, you know, as science developed, and he proved to be true, at least in every case that I know of. And he was a really very devout spiritual man, an excellent man. And he wrote a book called Fairies at Work in Play, in which he describes nature spirits of various types. And he describes seeing the sylphs in the air. And he says they sound strangely like Wagner's Walküres, not knowing that Wagner had done that. The Wagner, at the time that he was writing the music for the Walküre, must have had some inspiration of some type, because in a very short amount of time, I think it was something like only 3 years' time, he scored 1 million notes of music. And to do 1 million of anything is it's an enormous, enormous task. I was hoping to do a multimedia production of this and have slides of different presentations and to have the music at least give you all of the different themes. Because the whole opera, you can know without even hearing the German or understanding the German, you can know exactly what's going on just by listening to the themes. They're called Leitmotifs, and we'll come back to those in a little bit. Now, the occult gossip has it about us. This is a freewheeling course. The occult gossip about Wagner was that several lives earlier, probably two lives earlier, he was Sophocles. And Sophocles was one of the three great Greek tragedians. There was Aeschylus, who was, or Aeschylus, I don't know how you pronounce it, who was the sort of the right winger, and he was a traditionalist. I guess he could be called a Greek fundamentalist. And he wrote the Orestia trilogy and a few things like that. And he was a student of astrology, and he had some wild things happen to him in his life. And then there was the left winger was Euripides, who wrote the Medea and things like that. And he was almost sort of cynical. He has some of those great lines in his plays about people who don't want to admit the truth of themselves. I believe he has Jason in the Medea say, it was not I but my tongue that lied. And all of those cynical kinds of things. But Sophocles was sort of the, he drew on the spiritual side of things because he was an initiate into the Eleusinian mysteries. I don't know how deeply he got into them. But he also was a sort of a humanist in that he understood the frailty of the human connection or the human condition. And so this sort of makes sense to me because I'll bet you the life between Sophocles and Richard Wagner was spent somewhere as a woman learning music. Because it was a thing, because the Greeks, when they put on the dramas, they put them on at the times that the games were held and that they would have artistic contests too. Painters would make paintings for who could paint the most realistic painting, and there would be arts and crafts fairs, and the woman who had the best long hair got to sacrifice her hair for the lutenists, because they were, and the lute player who won the musical contest got the long hair because the very stretchy spun hair made excellent lute strings. And there were those sorts of things. And Wagner had these ideas. He carried a lot of these things on into his times. But most of the playwrights were Ionians because the Athenians were Ionians and they spoke a different language than the Spartans. And the Spartans were Dorians, but they were both specialists in that the Dorians wrote the music for the dramas, because all of the dramas were sung, actually. And the Ionians wrote the poetry. And they spoke different languages, and they had different cultures from each other, and they were constantly fighting with each other. And now Wagner was one of the first people to write his own words for his operas. And so he probably had enough of dealing with those rude Spartans and taught himself music in between. In fact, Wagner's operas aren't even called operas to a large extent. They're called musical dramas. He had ideas that there should be grand communes where people studied all of the arts and relating to the arts and things like that. And they should be spiritual communes, and they should be politically right and things like that. And in putting on all of his operas, he bankrupted the kingdom of Bavaria because the Duke or Prince Wilhelm of Bavaria was his friend, and Wagner kept getting to him for all of this money. Wagner actually expanded in his life, and he studied acoustics. And at Bayreuth, he created the opera house that still stands to this day. And they still celebrate the still celebrate the Wagner operas there. In fact, I just heard a talk from his grandson, an excerpt from a talk from his grandson, Gottfried, talking about how people deal with bigotry, because Wagner was accused of being anti-Semitic. But that's a subject I don't want to get into. I don't believe he was anti-Semitic, but I think it would take a long lot of understanding. But at any rate, he never intended to write this great epic when he began. What he was setting out to do, having that Mars in Aquarius, he wanted to do a self-portrait, and he wanted to do something on the death of a hero, because the death of heroes, as we just saw last week in the death and apotheosis of Heracles, are grand events. And so he searched around. He even thought of doing Buddha. In fact, he was even going to bring Buddha into some of his other dramas, because he was quite versed in a lot of different kinds of mystical thought. But he settled on the hero Siegfried, the conqueror, the truth-seeker conqueror, and he wrote the libretto for the Götterdämmerung called The Death of a Hero. But then he decided, what it turns out is that all of the words were written before the music. Before one note of music was scored, all the words were written, and all of the words were written in reverse order. So that he wrote the Götterdämmerung in words first, then he says, but nobody's going to know anything about why he was a hero. So he had to go back and write Siegfried previous to the Götterdämmerung so that people would know the heroic nature of Siegfried. And then he said to himself, but I have to know the roots of Siegfried. And so then he wrote the Valkyrie to see where how this hero came into being. But then he decided, my goodness, I have to have the mythical background for all of this, because all of this is not just an ordinary human drama, because we're going to see that the father and mother of Siegfried are Siegmund and Sieglinde, who are not only husband and wife, but their brother and sister, and that takes a lot of explaining. So he decided that he had to give the mythical background, and that is where he wrote the words to the opera that we're looking at now, Das Rheingold, the Rheingold. And then after he got all of the words written, he set out to write the music. And the interesting thing is, even though he's loved as a music, he writes marvelous homophonic music with these grand themes, which are called leitmotifs. And these motifs run all the way from the very opening chord to the very end chord, so that when Loki comes in or Loge comes in and there is fire, you hear the fire in the background. Or if the gods are afraid and trembling, throughout all of the many hours, I think something like 17 hours of opera to go through the whole of the Ring cycle. I've never sat down and gone through it all in one day. People have done it. People have gone insane listening to Wagner operas, or they have at least gone so that they start seeing things in the other world from listening to Wagner operas. I have one friend that listened to it all in one day's time, and it just totaled her out. It was such an overwhelming experience. So it's a lot of music, but all the way through, it's very intricate. These themes, whenever there's a reminiscence or a hint of anything, it's in the background, and it's wonderfully twined into the music that is being sung. Now, as wonderful as a musician as he is, he's probably even more exquisite as a poet. He writes lovely, lovely poetry. And I rate him better as a poet than as a musician. That's because I don't like homophonic music that much, but that's just a personal preference. Meaning it's all follows in one chord, and it all follows polyphonic as opposed to homophonic, is where you have many voices giving different lines of melody, and they build together and they produce They produce the chordal structure or the harmony. Yes, right. Most of our music, rock and roll, is all homophonic music. I like polyphonic music, like fugues and canons and free polyphony and things like that. That's it's more intricate music, and my introverted nature seems to revel in intricacy. So I like going with that. And the funny thing about writing the music is, he carved out the early themes in a big hurry, and then he got to Siegfried, and he got stuck. And it took him, I think he set down the music so that between the last act of Siegfried and the writing of the music for the God of Dammerung, and I think it was 15 years or some enormous hiatus, that he just let it all sit. He got called off to do other things, and he was actually in exile. He was exiled from Germany for his revolutionary activities and things like that. He had spent quite a bit of his life in Switzerland, and he spent a good hunk of it in England. And the most interesting man, I'm giving you a very positive view of him. There are some people that hate him totally. So 15 years later, I believe that's the number of years, he comes back and picks up the music where he left it off and writes the music for the last act. He does beautiful things in there. One thing is, by then he was very good friends with Verdi, and he actually got to writing operas toward the end instead of musical dramas. And right in the middle of the music for the funeral march for Siegfried and the God of Dammerung, and he puts the opening notes from the Fifth Symphony by Beethoven. Just, here's a man who's written 17 hours of music, and as a testament to another musician, another composer, he puts a hunk in there just as a homage to him. It is really big-spirited that somebody can do something like that. However, he's been known to do petty things with Beethoven also, because he actually rescored some of Beethoven's works because he liked his his own harmonies better, which is that's sacrosanct. All right, so all of this, it would be wonderful. Someday maybe I'll put together a multimedia version and just play all of the motifs and get them on a tape or have something. Maybe I'll have a computer by then, and I'll just be able to hit a key on the keyboard and have a motif play off in something. And I'll have the computer run a multimedia thing and such like that. All right, we've had an introduction then into mythography and into the mythographer Richard Wagner. Now what we're going to do is, if you have the book that Dan got out of the library, we're going to read right down the libretti. And tell the story, and in fact even read some quotes. The opera begins at the bottom of the Rhine River. And at the bottom of the Rhine River, there are several crags that are stick way up, pinnacles, I don't know what you'd call them. Three of them, I believe, and there are three Rhine maidens swimming around and sporting and playing in the water. Now, this gives us something about the timely nature of it. We could look at this as a cosmological part of the myth, or a cosmogenical part of the myth, if we liked, but I don't want to go that deep into it because it would be too hard to maintain three streams of parallel consciousness at the same time. And I don't want to get you as sick and tired of Siegfried and company as you got sick and tired of Heracles. After seven talks, we had quite enough of Heracles. But this settles it in time. The river is not really a river. It is the earth. And the earth at this time, this settles it in the Atlantean epoch. And in the Atlantean epoch, the south of the part of the earth was called Muspelheim. And Muspelheim was highly volcanic, and it was very hot, whereas the north was very cold, which leads one to believe that at one time in the creative epoch in early Atlantis, that the pole pointed straight toward the sun, and once one end of the earth was hot and the other end was cold. Not all of the water had condensed yet. There were three different Atlantean floods whereby the fog, there used to be a fog that surrounded the earth, according to the seers, that is like something like the fog that surrounds Venus. Only in the case of our earth, at first, in a very, very early time, it was made up of other gases, which were worked on by in the early recapitulations of evolution by bacterial types of life that later on became the anaerobic bacteria of the soil after they had given us oxygen so that we could recapitulate the oxygen states. But in Atlanta, we're trying to cut everything out in a few sentences here, and we might not get past the first page. But Muspelheim and Niflheim were the south and the north, and where they met, it was all steamy. And at this time, most of the human beings were very tall because being mammals, they could build larger bodies because the pressure was much more dense, and mammals can build more larger bodies when the atmosphere is more dense. And so there were giants in those days. Now, the Rhine maidens represent the angels, or they represent the innocents that are creative hierarchies. That is, they sport and they swim about through the atmosphere, and in their innocence, they sing things into being with the word of power, because they have this innocence. And the angels were especially innocent because they were polarized by the Lucifers, who are the fallen angels. And the fallen angels are the ones that caused the humans to fall, such that the humans became much, much too material for their own good. The Atlanteans in this early part of Atlantis actually still breathed through gill sacs yet, with the gill sacs, which later on became, through evolution, became our eustachian tubes and gave us the ability to have, to maintain the pressure, in internal pressure, matching the external pressure of the atmosphere in our times. But as they're swimming around, Albrecht comes up, and he comes out of a cleft in the earth, and this fissure is warm. It's volcanically warm yet, and because all in early Atlantis people had not yet completely developed warm red blood, they had to be where the earth was warm. And so Albrecht, being earthbound, was associated with the clefts in the earth, and the Rhine maidens, who are singing, and they have I wish I could have some of their singing here, because their singing ripples like waves ripple. And it's a really rolling, rippling tone of voice that they have. And they see Albrecht come out of the cleft, and he is ugly to them. He's ugly because all human beings are ugly, and used to be even more ugly because we fell. We fell for the line that the Lucifers gave to us. And everything that is made of sin is ugly. If you look at all human creation, just look at a junkyard in the woods or something like that. How ugly the human things are, how little they fit into nature, and how much of nature they destroy. Well, at the same time, you look at any little patch of weeds, and it's beautiful. There's a lovely, harmonious composition to it. And so they start teasing with him, and they start flirtatiously playing with him, and he starts to sneeze at this. And this is really, and the sneeze is written right into the libretto or into the directions that he's supposed to sneeze, because the sneeze has always been in tradition something that came into all of the jerky, unnatural movements that we make have been associated with evil. Like hiccups, for example, black magicians often put curses on people so that they hiccup themselves to death. They can't sleep or they can't do anything. You ever read that story by W. Somerset Maugham, where he talks about witnessing himself, somebody killed by having a curse put on him in Indochina? Maugham traveled the whole world over, and he tells how the person, after the curse was put on him, he had hiccups, and another one is vomiting, and all of those unnatural kinds of things. But sneezing, that's why in every language of the world, when you sneeze, there's a complete relaxation in order to be able to clear things out, and then with the sneeze, things get blown out. But in every language in the world, when you sneeze, people say something like Gesundheit or something like that, good health or something of that nature, and because they recognize that it is that we're getting rid of impurities. And so the sneeze then has always, if Albrecht's looking ugly wasn't enough to prove sin, sneezing was. And the Rhine maidens start flirting with him, and he can't hang on to any one of them. He wants to court them, but they always pull away because they're slippery. And that's sort of the way it is with us with regard to our guardian angel, which is our true higher nature. It slips away from us because we don't have that consciousness that we can hang on to it and hang on to it. Gradually, over years, we get a little better and we can hug and not let go, but it slips away so easily. And it also slips away because he's very divided in nature, because his heart isn't truly set on love. There's desire there, but there are other things that grab him also. Now, this carries us a step further from, remember when we've talked about various heroes grabbing river gods and holding on to them until they show their true spiritual nature, and when they show their true spiritual nature, you can get what you need from them. In this case here, if you look at Wagner's words, you get the idea that part of the reason that he can't hang on to the Rhine maidens is because he has a divided consciousness. And no one can attain to anything with either a weak intent, when one has to spiritually want to get somewhere in order to get somewhere, and you can't have a divided consciousness. You have to want God more than anything else in the world. This is what this is the essence of what Krishna tells Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita. This is the essence of the whole pre-introduction to the Rosicrucian cosmo-conception. It's the whole idea that unless you give your undivided attention, your undivided devotion and care to spiritual growth, you're not going to grow. So this is a really signal thing for us, that if we want to be united with our divine nature or cavort with the angels or such like that, only when we're pure. And that purity means our attention doesn't have any contaminants in. If you want to be loved by people, if you give someone your full attention and really care about them, they'll love you back. They'll love you back. And it's the same thing with the, you know, this is the secret. If you're courting somebody even and want to have a lover, if you give full attention, that is an irresistible thing. And so that's the way it is with the Rhine goal. And what happens is he loses heart, which is what often happens to us when we say, oh, the spiritual life is too difficult, it's too hard, it's not even worth striving for. I think I got to give up. And what happens then is with our selfishness, we tend to pity ourselves. And if we look at the things that Siegfried says, he feels sorry for himself. And he starts feeling really down. You know, oh, poor me, oh, woe is me. I'm always unsuccessful in love. And he never asks himself the question, how much do I love? Now, as this is going on, suddenly the sun begins to rise and it shines through the water. And when it does, there is a brilliant, brilliant light that shines in the water. And this is the Rheingold. And the sun or the light has struck it. And the Rheingold represents undifferentiated universal spirit. Gold has always been the symbol of spirit. And it is something that has in no way been worked. It's pure and it's natural and it's available for use. The Rhine maidens have been given the task by Wotan, the chief of the gods, who we're going to come to in a little bit. They have been given the task of guarding the Rheingold. But they're not very good guardians because they're so innocent, they're playing, and they trust everyone and such like that. And this gives us an even clearer idea of the timing of this. The fact that the sun is beginning to pierce and penetrate through the water indicates that the consciousness of humanity, which went in parallel to the physical evolution of the earth, is beginning to clarify and objectify also so that we can see things outside of us. Now, it's a very curious way that the Rhine maidens preserve the Rheingold, or they protect it. They protect it basically by just floating around it and singing their wisdom and such like that. Now, I don't know how to say this. It's going to turn out all the way through the opera that this is the only way that the Rheingold can be protected. That there is a kind of passive activism or active passivism such that they don't selfishly take the gold to themselves and they don't guard it with a greedy kind of vigilance. They guard it with a positivity that is the singing of their wisdom, that in fact almost is like a creation of gold in itself. They start singing the song that Albrecht overhears. And you think this seems awfully curious too, that they should sing a song in such a way that it can be overheard. But that's the way the truth is. The truth is like the ideal of science would really be. The thing is you can never hide your light under a bushel. And so the Rhine maidens, being the angels, the wisdom angels, sing out the truth and sing out the beauty of it because they must, because the truth must out. And in a way, they can't even be healthy beings without living out that kind of truth. They sing almost in the same way that birds do. Birds never tire of singing. I've seen wrens, little tiny wrens, put their entire energy into making their trilling little call, and their whole body shakes in order to get it out. It's a major effort, and they'll sing all afternoon that way. And they don't get tired, and if a human being could get one out like that, they would be tired. But at any rate, they sing out the story of the gold, and they say, only he who forswears love or he who forswears passion can take this gold and forge a ring out of it. And whoever forges a ring out of the gold can take the power inherent within the world, within the gold, and dominate and rule the entire earth. So this is the theme, this of the ring that runs all the way through. It represents self-conscious, ultimate cosmic power, so that one has power that cannot be resisted by the gods, or by the nature spirits, or by any other human being. But the thing is, you have to, here's what Voglinda says. Inheritance of the world, this is Voglinda. Inheritance of the world would be won by the man who from the Rheingold could fashion the ring that would bestow limitless power on him. And then Voglinda, a few lines later, says, only he who has renounced love's sway, only he who has spurned the sweets of sensual enjoyment, that man alone may attain the necessary magic to turn the gold into a ring. Now, if you'll notice, I'll read that again because it's very important. This is why his poetry is so beautiful. Only he who has renounced love's sway, only he who has spurned the sweets of sensual enjoyment. So there are two conditions. One is there has to be a foregoing of the universal love, meaning to say that one has to step outside of the universal love to objectively bend it and mold it. But also, that same one must give up sensualism. That is, he must, as Albrecht does, when he can't win the Rhine maidens, he becomes a kind of... So Albrecht becomes a kind of cynical celibate and selfishly swears to himself that if I can get power over all the earth, and the psychology in this is really beautiful, in that this is exactly the way people develop disturbed personalities or imbalanced personalities. Take a young man who's kind of awkward, and he's maybe very bright, and he tries to have a romance, and suppose a teenage girl laughs at him, which is not uncommon. Teenage males and females laugh at each other, and he takes it to heart, and he says, I'm never going to go for love at all. I'm going to study my math more. And so he studies his math more. And then he has a craving again for love and affection, and again he gets spurned, and he goes back to his math with all the more heart, and he becomes more antisocial, so that eventually he is completely unsuited for social intercourse. And he spurns all love and kindness and things like that. I live daily with people of this nature because I live with some very bright technical people that, to a large extent, many of them have spurned love and they've become misfit and unbalanced sociopaths in that they never did learn how to love and care about people, and they have this same kind of cynical, hard bitterness about them that Albrecht has. And so he foregoes passion as well, because the passion is associated with the creative energy that we have inside of ourselves. And even to build a self at all, we have to have that creative energy, even if we do it for selfish ends. You see, these very same things, this is a hook, and Albrecht doesn't realize it. Most human beings don't realize it, that we're hooked. We want to grow spiritually, and to a large extent, our first thought about it is selfish. It would be nice to have power. It would be nice to have all of this knowledge and be able to press people and go zap and heal them, you know, and be able to do all of those kinds of things. And then we're hooked. And when we're once hooked, all of the things that we do eventually, after all of the toil and all of the trouble, we get softened and we learn to love after all. And even though for a while we may have sociopathic characters, we grow up and we become loving and lovable human beings. But at any rate, he foregoes both love and he foregoes passion. Okay, so what he does is he steals the gold and he goes and he takes it into the underworld. And as he does so, he contemplates, and these are his words, "If I might win inheritance of the world for myself through thee," he's singing to the gold, "though I fail to win love, yet with cunning could I perhaps extort delight." "Mock on, then," he yells to the Rhine maidens, "mock on." So that this is one of the things, the self-pity. This is a real interesting study in psychology. The most difficult thing we have to do is the most difficult problem spiritually, transcendentally, as well as on this realm where we have to deal with desires and things like that, is the problem of self. Clearly, the ring of the Nibelungen is the ring of self. When we take the universal spirit and we create a self and we have the objective viewpoint of self from our own point of view, and we see ourselves as God in both the higher and lower senses, that is what the forging of the ring of the Nibelungen is all about. And that is the whole problem of self. We, as occult students, have the most difficult thing of all to deal with, and that is the problem of self. Because we have to be self-conscious about everything we do. We know we're trying to become divine. But in that same process of self-consciously trying to grow, we're developing more and more ego at the same time that we're developing higher spiritual self or higher spiritual ego. And it's sort of like, it's like feeding yourself. You get more, the more you take care of yourself, and the more you look out for number one, and number one is the same thing as I, the more you do that, the more you look out for number one and self, the more you have no outward love. You push other people away and you develop a cunning, just exactly as he said, "though I fail to win love, yet with cunning could I perhaps extort delight." And that's the kind of consciousness that the Atlantean humans had, that we had in those early days. We had an early, a nascent mentality that was cunning and instinctual. We still revert to that once in a while, yet when we're at our nastiest, worst, we know somebody's weak spots and we hamstring them and things like that. I haven't done that for a long time. In fact, I've had some really, in the last few days, I've had some nice things in bringing about cooperation where people didn't believe that other people were cooperating with them. Instead of being competing scientific groups, one was helping another out. That was a really nice thing to see. But at any rate, that's what produces the strangling kind of ring that tightens around the finger. All right, we've looked at the first scene. Then the whole scene shifts. I think there are about five scenes in this opera. The scene shifts to a realm that it isn't given here, but among the Norse it's called Asgard. I forget what the three realms are. Asgard is like Olympus to the Greeks. It's the realm of heaven that was ruled by Zeus. What we live in is the Midgard. And the Midgard had this great serpent around it, which was the ocean. And in both the Greek and Norse mythology, the Midgard was ruled by Poseidon, the lord of the ocean. I forget what the underworld is called, and who is the ruler of that. We know that among the Greeks it was called Tartarus, and it was ruled by Hades. And those three brothers were lords of the three realms. But this takes place in Asgard, and Wotan is sleeping. And when the scene opens up behind him at the summit of the mountains, it takes place up in the mountain heights, and at the summit of the mountains is this beautiful, big, brand new castle. And this castle is called Valhalla. And this is a castle that, this is the whole struggle for the gods. It was a castle that Wotan had built for him because he was insecure. And he wanted to have an impregnable castle. And mind you now, this is the new heaven and the new earth that is being formed. We're right at the transition between the Atlantean epoch and the Aryan epoch in which we live now. And we're right between the times of the Rhine maidens and living in the Rhine River and the time where the gods live at an infinitely high heaven that's invisible to us, and we live in the clear air, the Ariana, the place where we can breathe fresh air instead of breathing through the water. And he has contracted, at the advice of Loj, who is Loki, or who is the Saturn, Mercury is the chief god, in the same way that Jupiter, Zeus, is the chief gods of the chief of the gods of the Romans and Greeks. Wotan, or Mercury, is the chief god of the Norse and Teutonics. And he has contracted with these nature forces. I don't know how to talk about them any other way. They're called the Frost Giants. And the Frost Giants, he has promised to give his sister and sister-in-law, they're both the same being because he married his sister also, who is called Freya. And Freya is the Norse Venus. And remember when Heracles had the apples of the Hesperides, which were the apples of Venus that gave everlasting life and creative energy? Well, Freya, in the same way, has the golden apples, which gives the gods immortality. This, again, has to do with living off of the stars. Clearly represent very high divine beings on the level of our God, so to speak, of our solar system or higher, and they emanate a creative love that all of the other demigods, or all of the gods that to us they're gods, but that they live off of this creative love in the same way that you and I live off of fruits and vegetables and things like that. But they emanate this creative love. And at the hinting of Loj, he says, you can have this impregnable castle, and you can have these frost giants build it for you and promise them anything. Promise them Freya. Promise them that they can have love. So this whole thing, the whole opera is about love, love forsworn, love promised, and love fulfilled. In fact, we're going to see that is the theme that comes through in many, many levels from beginning to the end. So this is where things stand. And Wotan wakes up, and he's been dreaming. And he's been dreaming about being protected by his new castle, and Fricka is his wife and sister, and she's waking him up, and saying, look at the beautiful new house you had built for me. And his consciousness, this is really very beautiful the way Wagner does this, his consciousness, he's first singing his dream out in his sleep, and then Fricka wakes him up, and he continues his song from the sleeping state to the waking state, which is really, I don't know if you try to do a morning exercise, but it's really difficult. But after years and years and years, you get nearer. So that as you come back to your body, even though you don't remember all of the things that happen in the inner world, you begin to wake up as you engage yourself with your body. And the whole purpose of the morning exercise is to bring the divine intelligence that we have when we're out of the body, when we actually can't even say I in the same egoistical kind of way. You try to bring that in and wake up with that as your meditation. So you're beginning right from the beginning of the whole cosmos, and you're passing from a dream state to a waking state, and that the transition between the two is unbroken. And that is to learn to have the consciousness that is continuous, so that we'll never have to sleep again. We can leave the body sleeping, but our consciousness can go back and forth from the two realms, and it can be continuous. And that's precisely what Wagner does to introduce the consciousness of the gods, that from waking up or transferring their consciousness from one realm to another, it's done like a meditation that goes from a dream and it goes into the waking state. Now, what's happened here is parallel to what has happened in the first scene, that in order to have power for the universe, over the universe, Alberich has given up love. He's given up love to be able to steal and mold gold to his own pleasing. Well, Wotan has done exactly the same thing. He, in order to have the security of his heavenly battlements and to have this glorious, showy palace, which is something like Madison's swimming pool, which they want to have in an inopportune location where kids are going to get killed, just so that it'll be a grand, showy palace that anybody that comes into town can see that Madison has an Olympic swimming pool for their kids. I got to put a political thing in the air, because I don't want to see that park destroyed, and I don't want to see the swimming pool. I'd like to see it right across the street where land has been offered for free, and it's right near the underprivileged neighborhood, so the little kiddies could walk to the swimming pool and not have to cross a six-lane highway, because the John Nolan is planned to be a six- or eight-lane highway in places. And that's revolting. But at any rate, the parallel is that Wotan has given up love in the person of Freya in order to have this really showy palace. And what happens is there is a really sassy argument between Fricka and Wotan. Now, Fricka is another Venusian character, but she represents Fricka as the Libra type of Venusian, which has a good sharp intellect to it and lays down the law, because the law is Libra. And the marriage partner, or she is the goddess of marriage, and we're going to see throughout the operas that she lays down the law, and it has to do about marriage and home and things like that. And she says, you so shamelessly, you insolent creatures, gave away Freya, my fair sister, well pleased with your thievish trading. What then is sacred and worthwhile to your hard hearts when you men lust after power? And a few lines further on, Wotan says, if you would trap me in a fortress, wife, you must not complain. If captive in the citadel, I, a god, conquer the world outside for myself. He's saying, like, if you want me to be domestic, you know, you're going to have to pay a price for this. And where does it go after that? There's one more quote that I wanted to read, but I guess I let it slip away on me. So at this time, while the two of them are arguing, instead of getting themselves safely inside the castle, they argue. And as they're arguing, here come the frost giants, Fafnir and Fasolt. Yeah, and they got real booming theme. In fact, Wagner, the theme of the giants, Wagner invented new musical instruments in order to be able to play that theme. He developed something between a tuba and a baritone. It was called a tube. And he invented a trombone that had two slides on it, two tubes on the slide. And I had a friend that had a number of them at one time. And I was playing around with one time that and I was just blowing a note and I just let out the slides like that all the way. And it felt as though my diaphragm went up into my Adam's apple, you know, because it was such a release of pressure when that went way out like that. Really quite something. But at least the giants represent dumb forces of nature. And they represent dumb forces of nature in two ways. That is, they are really unself-conscious. You see, there is an intelligence that is divine that has been sacrificed into matter, that works as an instinct. This unites with the becoming consciousness in matter, and it produces a sort of cunning-like quality. And relative to the light of intelligence of the gods, which can see things and know things and create things, this is dumb. And that's what the frost giants are, is that kind of dumb. But they're dumb in another way, in that they're impersonal. They don't know that they really have a personality. They're so bad off, they're so underprivileged, that they don't know what they're missing. There's that kind of ignorance. They don't have that same kind of slick sharpness that the gods have. I'll try to give give you some notion of what they're like. They're arguing with Wotan, and Wotan has sworn by his spear, which we'll come up with at a later time, we'll talk about it, and all of the laws of the cosmos he has carved into the side of his spear as runes. In short, the whole story of the whole cosmos and all the laws in between run up and down the staff of the spear of Wotan. And he has sworn by that to the gods that they may have Freya and such. And then Fossil says to him, "What do you say? Ha! Do you meditate betrayal? Betrayal of the treaty? Are the things your spear protects the runes of agreement, of agreed contract? Are they mere sport to you?" And he goes on. Later on, he says, "Son of light, lightly swayed, hear and take heed. Honor treaties. What you are only through treaties. There is where your power is based." Meaning to say that Wotan and the gods are bound by the law. In the same way that the angels are innocent, in that they don't have a self-consciousness and they can be free are conduits of spirit without any impedance to the passage of wisdom and insight through them. They are also subject to all of the laws of the spirit. And when it comes to the gods who are the intelligent creators using that consciousness, if you identify yourself with the laws of nature, then you become subject to the treaties. This is why some people don't swear vows. Because once you swear a vow, you have to live by that. And when you have to live that out, and you might swear a vow now, but conditions might change, and that vow becomes archaic, and it turns out to be a very unwise vow to have sworn in the first place. This is why Christ says, let your yeas be yeas, and let your nays be nays. So the self-conscious creators, like the gods that are in heaven, they work through the laws of nature, and they are bound by them. This is why it's also not a good idea, if you're an astrological student, to become a predictor. Because if you make concrete predictions, you are then aligning yourself with the forces of destiny. You are not aligning yourself with the forces of creative freedom. You have intentionally become something not even like a prophet. You have become like an augur of destiny. And when you are an augur of destiny, it takes away from your freedom. You might get all kinds of honors and be praised by people of the world, but you are not a participator. You know what I mean? You have suddenly become like a Charlie McCarthy for the agencies of destiny, and it much better if you could foresee something coming instead of being a tool of destiny, just going out and making these brittle, self-grandiose, vain predictions. If you can set out so that you can change conditions or change people so that they can get much more out of what's going to come off rather than make predictions. Beside that, most of the time you're going to be very humbled. If you get involved with the vanity of predictions, you're very much likely to get humbled. Okay. So what happens is that the gods are, the giants are saying, all right, pay up. You know, it's the first of the month. Everything is due, and it's due with interest. Now, the chief of the gods, having driven the bargain and made the treaty, realizes that he's stuck with it. And he can't do anything about it, and he has to live by it. But he starts stalling for time. And as he's stalling for time, some of the other gods come. Thor comes, only Thor is called Donner, same Donner that's in the Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. Is named Donner is German for thunderer, and Thor was the Lord of Thunder. We'll talk about that sometime at a later time. And another, who's the other one? Fro comes, which is another name for Balder, who is the god of youth and one of the divinities that represents the sun. They're not so shy, and Donner comes up with his hammer, and he wants to have it out with the giants and says, all right, you want to settle the score. This is our sister that you want to take away with you. We don't want to give her up, and let's have it out right now. And that's the way it often is, that when we're filled with the Spirit and we don't realize that we have given ourselves over to the law and we've given ourselves over to our central leader or to our central hierarchy, they have this spirited kind of attitude. And what happens is Wotan has to restrain them. And he has to restrain them so that they don't start this great big struggle. By the way, you know that Wotan is a one-eyed god, or is portrayed as a one-eyed god. I forgot to bring that part out of the thing. When he's arguing with Fricka, his wife, he says, I sacrificed an eye for you. And He actually sacrificed one of his eyes to be able to have the wisdom of the future and to know some of the things that were coming so that he could prepare himself and win the bride at the same time. And so he's often pictured as having a patch over one of his eyes, usually his left eye. I don't believe that that's true. I believe that it is the third eye, that is the focus of the divine spirit, is the one that he sacrificed to get his divine wife. He couldn't use it for himself, and he has to, when things are blocked from him, because there are things that we have to learn by experience, and we can't just have them told to us by prediction, when we sacrifice the spiritual eye for the service of the gods, we can never use it for our own selfish ends. But at any rate, here's this one-eyed god with the stick, with the spear, with all of the runes carved in it. And like all mercurial characters, he stalls for time. And he stalls and stalls because he's waiting for Loj to come, because Loj is the one that made the contract in the first place. And what happens is he stalls long enough and Loj starts coming. And you can hear Loj from a long way off. And the strange thing is that Loj is clearly a Saturnine being. But we know Saturn as being cold. Loj here is associated with fire. His whole theme is like a dancing fire. If you hear the theme for Loj in the operas, it's going up and down, it's dancing the same way that flames dance. And this actually, if you read in the poetry and you read with great care, you'll see that the Saturn period, remember how many of you are familiar with, you're familiar with the Rosicrucian cosmic conception and the whole idea that at the beginning that all there was darkness, which is associated with Saturn, and warmth. And that is the warmth that this fire is of. Very often, the planets exoterically and esoterically have different meanings. Whereas exoterically, Mars is the planet of bravery. Esoterically, Venus is the planet of bravery, because love is the only thing that can get you past some of the things in the inner worlds, whereas just mere courage is not enough alone. On the other hand, Mars on the inner plane becomes the planet of dedication, because it has a passion about all things. So at any rate, Loj is a shyster. He is a lawyer type that knows very cunningly how to make all kinds of bogus deals and how to get out of them. I think this has more to do than with the character of Saturn alone. If Saturn represents the initiation of all things in the seed state and the final condensation of all things in the seed state, it represents the ultimate beginning and the ultimate end, and the beginnings are the very roots of what are going to become the ends. You see what I'm trying to say? The loophole and the downfall of creation are in the insemination of creation in the first place. And this is why Saturn is the divinity of loopholes. Because in order to create something in the first place, because you can't create everything, you have to limit. And in that act of limitation is an opening, is a weakness, and that weakness eventually becomes the Achilles heel, or it becomes the Siegfried spot, as we're going to find out two operas from now, the weak spot that causes the whole downfall of everything. And so the loophole thing is not just a selfish thing. It represents the very means whereby creation can take place in the first place. So the way Loj works is Oh, I should look. I should get some of the should get some of the readings out here. I'm not doing very good about staying really close with the readings. What happens is that Loge appears and Wotan starts giving him the business, saying, "You've got to get me out of this contract. You've got to get me out of this contract. Here I'm going to lose love. I'm going to lose the very thing that sustains me." And Loge, of all things, tells him, "You've got to honor your contracts. Your contracts are sacred because you don't have anything to live by if you do try to dodge your contracts." And he says, "I didn't tell you to build a castle. I just told you you could have an impregnable castle, and I told you that these giants were a bunch of dummies." He says, "I didn't tell you to do anything." And you see this, this is one of the biggest tricks that is used by politicians, that is used by black magicians, and you find it most in insane people. They don't take responsibility for anything. They can dispersonally effect whatever they would like to effect, but they don't take personal responsibility. You see, like a martial type of individual or some type of individual, they're right inside what they do. But if you do something from outside and you sort of like speak through a dummy, then you can get away from all guilt. And of course, this is raising the spirits of Fafnir and Fasolt, who are the two giants, or they represent the whole kingdom of giants, of nature spirits, and such like this. And they're heartened by all of this. And Loge almost starts scolding Wotan, saying, "I don't know why you ever agreed in the first place to give up the goddess of love, your sister and sister-in-law. Why would you ever do that?" He says, "I've traveled the whole world over, and I'm going here and I'm going there." And he says, "I've only seen one person who has ever forsworn love. And that is this Albrecht character. He forswore love just to merely steal the gold of the Rhine maidens and make a ring that would give him power over everything." And you see how he did this. He acts first like he's scolding Wotan, and he acts like he's in favor of keeping the treaty, and he acts on the side of the giants. And as he's scolding Wotan, he starts telling him all about how wonderful love is. And the giants are saying, "Wow, we're going to have beautiful Freya. We're going to have love now." And he's saying, "There's only one being that's ever forsworn love, and that's because he wants power over the whole universe." And he's got him hooked. You see what I mean? He was actually all along, in a very cunning, clever way, he was hooking them into this thing that he was going to have them give up their claim to Freya. Because, as it turns out, as he starts saying what a ridiculous character this Albrecht is, and he's nothing but a big troublemaker, he's warning Wotan about the problems that could be coming there. And he knows that Fafnir and Fasolt have had trouble with Albrecht because he's given them a lot of trouble, and he's always gotten out of it. And so now he has them hooked. See if I can find the lines here where he actually does the hooking. Yeah, here he starts talking about it. "It is a trinket in the depths of the water for the delight of laughing children. But should any man succeed in forging it into a round hoop, it would help that man to the highest power and win him the whole world." So the whole, now every time this theme of the ring comes up and the power of the ring, yeah, it's too bad we don't have the operas themselves with us. And another place then he says, here it is. A magic rune forces the gold into a ring. No one knows it, but he who renounces blessed love may easily practice it. Does that not appeal to you? So the whole notion is, and this is really true, this has a really great insight. His poetry is wonderful. He says, but he who renounces blessed love may easily practice it. Because what happened is, the reason why we can do things that give us power so that the gods can't touch us is because our consciousness is of a totally different kind. When we, in fact, forswore love at the fall, and we entered into matter more deeply and developed an objective external kind of consciousness, we developed a brain mind that is completely separative. And this separative brain mind, where it takes one thing at a time and can look at every little thing in that way, is not at all the way the gods see things. The gods see things in wholes. And as long as we function with this kind of brain consciousness, it's foreign to the realm of the gods. And we have a power that, in fact, we can rule the whole world. The material world so far, we're doing wondrous things with ruling the material world and destroying it all along the way. But we haven't gotten yet so that we can apply it occultly and do it to the inner spiritual worlds, but hopefully we'll be redeemed by that time. But you can see that the hook is set that way. And then he sets the hook for Wotan. And he said, Wotan is worried also about Albrecht now, and he's worried about losing love, and he's worried about somebody else having the power to overcome him beside the giants. And Fro says the prize could be carried off easily now without forswearing love. And Loge says, ridiculously easy, without any craft, mere child's play. And Wotan says, advise how. He's already got Loge in it. He says, by theft. What a thief stole, you steal from the thief. Was anything more easily secured? That's sort of like that mafia notion that that kind of money has no home. Something that's stolen never will stay anywhere. But Albrecht guards himself with evil weapons. You must proceed subtly and judiciously. If you drag the thief to justice and make him give back the red bauble, the gold to the Rhine daughters, for that is what they beg of you. Well, he's playing on Mercury to fulfill his duty to protect the gold for the Rhine daughters.
The red
bauble? Bauble. Yeah. Gold, they saw, is red-orange. Ball, and the bauble is a little trinket. And Fafnir says, believe me, the glittering gold is worth more than Freya. Eternal youth would be secured to him too, who conquers it through the magic of the gold. So he's got everybody hooked now. He's got Mercury, or Wotan, he's got hooked that he's going to steal it away, and it's going to be... That everything is going to come out all right. So what happens is there's a kind of legal blackmail. To make sure that things are done, the frost giants take away Freya. They say, let us bear her away from here till evening, mark well, we will guard her as hostage. We shall return, but if we come and the Rhine gold does not lie there, ready as ransom, bright and red. So they got to have all the gold by evening. And that's an important time. That's when all the elements meet, fire, air, earth, and if it's over an ocean or something like that, all four elements meet. And evening is like the seventh house where all laws and treaties and compacts and things like that are sworn. And it's where the things of spiritual conviction are accomplished. And so the treaty is to be sealed one way or another. They've got a legal blackmail. As they take her away, all of the gods become very, very weak, and like a whole mist comes over, and the gods turn gray. The way they do it with lighting, and they do it with screens and things like that, it's really neat to see when you see it on stage sometime. It would be worth a trip if you ever want to do it. You have to stay for a week in Seattle. But there are all kinds of nice... I haven't seen it since they have a new theater out in the mountains now that is dedicated just to putting on the Wagner operas. They used to do it in the opera house that was in the old World's Fair Park. And they've got the, you know, you can ride around on a monorail and all that. It's a pretty neat thing. I think if you write the Chambers of Commerce in Seattle, you can get a listing for when it's celebrated. It's in 1 week is in German and 1 week is in English. But at any rate, the gods are getting weak, and Loge takes Wotan, and they find a cleft in the mountain, and they go down to the underworld, and that's where we'll break for tonight. And we'll find out whether they indeed get the gold and whether they ransom Freya and get into more of the entanglements of the gods. See, this is what I like, because when I was a kid, I lived on a farm, and about a quarter of a mile from our farm was a crossroads where there was a grocery store and a tavern and a dance hall and things like that. And most of the people spoke German, and so there were a lot of polka dances and square dances and things like that in the dance hall. But in the summertime, they had movies. This was back in the 40s, outdoor movies. So it had to be a non-rainy day, and they'd hang this big sheet out there. And I remember the movie of the Durango Kid, who was the good guy. And the Durango Kid... the bad guys got him, and they threw him down a well. And the next week it rained, and we never got back to the movies again. In all of my life growing up, I never found out what happened to the Durango Kid. And that brought into my consciousness a love of cereals. So next time we'll finish out this opera and maybe begin the next one or set the background for the next one. And... begin talking about the roots of Siegfried the Hero. This is really fun stuff. It's storytelling of the best type. And Wagner does this in a grand style. He used to worry about whether his dragons were big enough or whether the Rhine River was realistic enough. And he has all of these grand scenes, you know, in the seductions. There's a couple of seduction scenes in the operas. And you know that he's known all the lines of seduction and all the lines of a true love affair and things like that. And it's really beautiful stuff. And so we'll have some more fun next time.